So yes, building the Buddha land. We've got this ongoing series of different evenings, different speakers, different topics under the theme, which I've started to think of as a mosaic. You know, they might come in from all sorts of different angles, cover different aspects of the theme, and hopefully, eventually, we'll build up a whole picture of what this Buddha land is all about. But what is the Buddha land? The Buddha land is a place where it's easy to practice the Dharma, basically. It's a place where we're influenced by the Buddha, and it's made up of living beings, so all of us. Living beings who want to evolve, Sangharakshita specifies, actually. And this image, theme, is really, it's a myth. I've been thinking, this is a myth of the Mahayana. So the Mahayana is the second great phase in the development of Buddhism, which emphasizes the compassionate, altruistic dimension of the Dharma life and the ungraspability of all experience and universal Buddhahood, so not limited to a particular Buddha, a particular time, a particular place, Buddhahood available to all of us. And it expresses all of that in a rich world of archetype and myth and symbol. Building the Buddha land particularly is a myth which communicates the third of the three jewels, that communicates Sangha. That's what it's really telling us, demonstrating to us. So I'm going to start with that general picture today and talk about what is myth, about the cosmic context that this Buddha land myth is set in and the effect of that on us, about myth as a call to action and some fears or pitfalls we might have in engaging with myth in general and the scale of the cosmos in particular. So what is myth? In common parlance, it often means something untrue or imaginary or sort of irrelevant and, you know, just kind of made up and fantastical. But we have a different understanding in Triratna. Well, not just in Triratna, but there's a more particular understanding of what we mean by myth. So not something untrue, but something that carries a different sort of truth, a different variety of truth. Sangharakshita is very kind of clear on this in loads of places. It's where I've kind of gained my understanding of this other way of operating, of communicating. But I've come across a few bits lately by Karen Armstrong, who's a writer on religion. She's not a Buddhist. She writes for The Guardian, and she's written some books about religion. And she seems to have a similar understanding that she expresses very clearly. So she writes, for instance, "Most pre-modern cultures believed there were two recognised ways of arriving at truth. The Greeks called them mythos and logos. Logos. Both were essential, and neither was superior to the other. They were not in conflict, but complementary, each with its own sphere of competence. Logos, reason, was the pragmatic mode of thought that enabled us to function effectively in the world, and had therefore to correspond accurately to external reality. But it could not assuage human grief or find ultimate meaning in life's struggle. For that, people turned to mythos, stories that made no pretensions to historical accuracy, but should rather be seen as an early form of psychology. If translated into ritual or ethical action, a good myth showed you how to cope with mortality, discover an inner source of strength, and endure pain and sorrow with serenity." So that's how I'd like to encourage you all to engage with our theme as we go on through the year, as something that we can engage with, that can help us know how to act and how to cope with life, that's talking to us in a different way than reason does. Sangharakshita says, The whole point about myth is that it is a realm of not clearly defined meanings, but of undefined, even indefinable meanings. So we'll be building up this mosaic picture of the Buddha land from these indefinable meanings, putting together a whole sense from that. So the cosmic setting of this myth, the big picture. So the ancient Indian view of the cosmos was big, and this is especially emphasised in the Mahayana, so this is particularly the setting for the Buddha land. So I thought I'd just play you a little bit of Sangharakshita from his talk on building the Buddha land, where he just starts to kind of move into saying what is the Buddha land and describe where it's set.
Heading under which we're going to consider the topic of building the Buddha land. So what is the Buddha land? In order to answer this question, it'll be necessary to say a few words about Buddhist cosmology. I won't say very much about it because I've dealt with the subject at some length in A Survey of Buddhism, as well as in the course of the 8 lectures on the Sutra of Golden Light. The first thing that we have to realize, the first thing that we have to appreciate, is that Buddhism, traditional Indian Buddhism, sees space as infinite. And it sees infinite space as occupied by infinite worlds, infinite world systems. Each world system consists of 4 continents surrounded by a ring of iron mountains. Don't take all this too literally, it's sort of poetic imagery, you may say. Each world system also contains 3 planes: a plane of sensuous desire, a plane of pure form, and a formless plane. So each world system is thus multidimensional. 1,000 such world systems, according to Buddhist cosmology, make up one small universe. 1,000 small universes make up one middling universe, and 1,000 middling universes make up one great universe. You can go further than that, but we won't this evening. A Buddha land corresponds to one great universe, or to a multiple thereof. In other words, if that isn't quite clear, it corresponds to one great universe, or it may be even bigger. And it's called a Buddha land because it represents the sphere of influence, the sphere of spiritual influence of one particular Buddha. And that particular Buddha is responsible for the spiritual development of all the living beings in all the world systems within that great universe or number of great universes. So one can see from all this that Buddhism teaches not only an infinity of world systems, but also an infinity of Buddhas, or at least, if that sounds too outrageous, at least a plurality, a very considerable plurality of Buddhas. But not all the great universes are so fortunate as to have a Buddha presiding over them, so to speak. Some, unfortunately, are devoid of a Buddha. And at this point, we have to remember that for the Mahayana, no less than for the Hinayana, the Buddha is not some sort of god. He starts off as an ordinary human being, just like anybody else. He takes up the spiritual life. He takes the Bodhisattva vow, that is to say, the vow to attain supreme perfect enlightenment for the benefit of all. And he follows the Bodhisattva path for thousands upon thousands of lives and he follows it within the world systems of one particular great universe, the universe for which one day he will have the spiritual responsibility. And in the course of that time, in the course of all those thousands of lives, he comes into contact with an enormous number of living beings, and he helps them to the best of his ability. And eventually, of course, after those thousands upon thousands of lives of spiritual endeavour, as a bodhisattva, he becomes a Buddha in his last lifetime. Now, there's a distinction made in the Mahayana tradition between a Buddha's sphere of knowledge and his sphere of influence,
which we'll probably talk about another week. So we're used to knowing about the size of the universe and universes in a way, but for a pre-scientific view, that was pretty big. And it's not only vast in space, but it's got these different dimensions, different planes, and it's vast in time. Buddhism's view is that there's no discernible beginning of anything, in a way, or, you know, there are just always conditions rolling on that have caused this universe to happen. This universe will die, another universe will come into being, and that goes backwards and forwards, as, you know, further than we can imagine. So in time and space and dimensions, whatever that means, we're in a really kind of big place. So just what effect does that have to remember that, or to contemplate? You know, that's where we're sitting, in the vastness of this cosmos. It reminded me of seeing a film when I was a little girl. They showed us a film at school. I was probably about 9 or 10. I don't know really what it was. It was had a lot of beautiful time-lapse photography and a lot of stuff about the stars and things. But I remember them using this illustration and saying, now just imagine how many grains of sand there are in a teaspoon. Now, how many are there on this beach? And it was a, you know, view of a beautiful big beach. And I think that was how, I don't know if it then went into how many are there in the desert or whether that was it, whether it was just the beach, but that was the number of stars in the universe or the, you know, or something, some universe. And I just remember being kind of boggled by this, just trying to even imagine the grains of sand in a teaspoon. And the Buddha uses this illustration too. Some of the suttas have. How many grains of sand are there in the Ganges? Well, so many, you know, blah, 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 whatever. He uses that same metaphor. But yeah, as a little girl, I was sort of like, you know, like, wow, my mind doesn't stretch that far. I can't quite imagine that. And it, you know, it definitely had a kind of really opening effect on me, this sort of sense of awe, wonder at the vastness of things. And in that, there's a sort of sense of certain possibility and, well, of how small our normal concerns, you know, the things we get caught up in really are in the vastness of space, I think. So all that's positive. So I was wondering, what does do that for you? What really opens you up to that sense of wonder, of awe, of possibility? It's something you could talk about in the groups later on. I know for some people it is watching Brian Cox programmes about astronomy and all that, the vastness of stars and things. But it might be gazing at the sky. I spend quite a lot of time just looking out of my window, just watching the clouds go by and sort of looking into the blue bits and letting myself be absorbed into the bigness of space that way. Might be watching the sea, a big sea, that sort of contemplating its depth and its movement and how far the horizon is. Might be being absorbed in certain sorts of music, or perhaps poetry just tips you into a different sort of world, or other art forms. It might be contemplating the Buddha, might be chanting. There's all sorts of things that can just give you that sense of, ah, wow, yes, there's more to life than my little concerns. It might be just actually really opening to the scale of the suffering in the world, the number of, you know, just how vast and big that is. It might be the wonder of how different people are. Just that sort of like, wow, she really thinks differently to me, and, you know, how does that work? Just, she's got a whole different story and different world that she's living in than I am. What, you know, that's amazing, and each of us has. How amazing. And I was thinking lots of those things are kind of like macrocosmic views. They are kind of looking big, looking at the universe or whatever. But I think you get the same sense by looking really small as well. Vimala Vajri's introduced me to a little botanical lens which magnifies things hugely, and you can really see the detail and the colour and the sort of scintillatingness of flowers. This sort of imagine, you know, kind of go into that world in a way, into the heart of a flower, and that, you know, that can have an opening effect to the wonder of things as well. Or I guess if you're really inspired by kind of quantum physics, you know, that's getting kind of subatomic, isn't it? And that's going really small, but it's opening up like, whoa, we don't understand what things really are. We don't kind of get it quite in the way we normally experience things. And certainly meditation can be like that. Now, I know if I kind of really get into my experience, all the sort of different sensations going on, then that opens up a sort of spaciousness. It's like I can start to feel the space between my thoughts and the space between my sensations, and almost like the space between my molecules of my being is how it sometimes feels. I can get this sort of inner sense of openness and things being different than I thought. And I think in meditation, actually, ideally, you're kind of doing both those things at once. So I'm kind of feeling into the space within, and I'm kind of feeling, sensing, imagining how vast space is around me. Certainly, if I'm feeling the boundlessness of metta, if that's really radiating, there's kind of a sense of there being no limit. So there's this kind of very detailed and this very big picture, both kind of holding together. I think that's when things are really sort of starting to open up and happen for me. All of these things just start to give a glimpse of, well, really the ungraspability of all experience. That the names we give things really aren't the things. There's more to everything than we normally stop to notice. Which is, it's the view of the Mahayana, the sort of emptiness, wisdom view. Certainly gives me a sense of wonder, awe, that things are a bit more magic than I think. Things are possible. There's a sense of potential in it, in that sort of aliveness of things. So yeah, what gives you any glimpse of that sort of sense of life? What does that for you? What conditions give rise to that sense for you? But there is a possible downside to all this, a sort of pitfall. I also remember as a little girl kind of going, wow, but I then knew that I was no more important than an ant. You know, it's like, if the world's that big, I'm so small that I don't really count. You know, things start to feel a bit pointless. A bit meaningless. What does it mean for us all to be sort of scurrying around like ants? What's that really about? So I think when we're not really at home in ourselves, when we're not really in touch with metta, when we're not really in touch with a sense of our own value, not able to really abide in ourselves, and when we're not really in touch with how precious life is, then this bigness, this openness can be a bit more of a bleak place. Also, if I try and take on the suffering of the world, it can just feel too much. So I just sort of, I won't look, really. It's just too much. I can't make enough difference. I don't feel significant enough very easily. So I think it's really important to kind of keep that being at home, self-abiding, as well as the big picture. You need both of those. Sharon Salzberg talks about this. She quotes an Indian teacher who says, "Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. Between the two, my life flows. And wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. Between the two, my life flows. Sharon Salzberg says, I am nothing does not mean there is a bleak wasteland within. It does mean that with awareness we open to a clear, unimpeded space without centre or periphery, nothing separate. If we are nothing, there is nothing at all to serve as a barrier to our boundless expression of love. Being nothing in this way, we are also, inevitably, everything. Everything does not mean self-aggrandizement, but a decisive recognition of interconnection. We are not separate. Both the clear open space of nothing and the interconnectedness of everything awaken us to our true nature. This is the truth we contact when we meditate, a sense of unity beyond suffering. It is always present. We merely need to be able to access it. So yeah, I think it's really important to keep both poles really alive so that life flows between them. And for me, myth and ritual are important to keep alive the sense of everything, the sense of value and goodness in my life, that we are in a universe that contains a Buddha. It's not an empty universe. It's a Buddha field, a sphere of the Buddha's influence. And to notice that really acting, influencing my life, acting in my life. And also to know that together we're more than a sum of our parts as a Sangha. I can't do much for the world. I really can't. I am too small and insignificant. But together we might just make a difference. I think one of the strongest examples in my life of really engaging with myth and with ritual was the period before my ordination, when for about 18 months I was doing a practice called the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice, in which one imagines the Buddha of the past, the Buddha of the future, and a whole assembly of archetypal forms and Buddhist teachers of the past and the present and the Dharma books and cassette tapes in my day, but probably websites now, all the forms of the Dharma and all the teachers of it that you can imagine. And you bring those all to mind, you imagine you're surrounded by the whole of humanity who are all together are responding to this great vision of the values coming down from the Dharma. And you say some verses and prostrate before your imagined sense. So it's a very sort of acted out mythic picture. It's like stepping into a whole drama. And having done prostrations for several minutes, you then sit down and receive blessings from this vision, in a way. So you receive white light, you're bathed in white light. And I couldn't always engage. I did this for about 18 months, three times a week. And sometimes I was tired and I was blocked and I couldn't feel anything, couldn't see anything. But just engaging, stepping into that drama had a huge effect on me. It was like I felt at home in the universe. I knew my place. I knew what I was doing with my life. I knew where I was in relation to the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha around me. And I knew what I was doing, what was important. I didn't need to be perfect. I didn't need to be big. I didn't need to do anything. I just needed to keep responding to what was of value to me and open up to the blessings of that. And it was like a call to action. It was on the basis of that that I decided to buy the dental practice that I was then working in, because I wanted to have more actual, tangible influence in my world. I wanted to bring those values into being in my workplace more fully. That was a really creative and growthful thing for me to do for several years after that, to be just really trying to kind of create something on the basis of my values. So yeah, Karen Armstrong, who I quoted earlier, does also talk about the importance of mythic action and, you know, it being a call to action. She says it's not just, myth isn't just something you believe, it's something you have to act on and try out for yourself. It's up to you to take the next step, she says, and make the truth of the myth a reality in your own life. The only way to assess the value and truth of any myth is to act upon it. Time whizzing by. See, I just wanted to flag up some fears we might have of engaging with myth in this way, or some possible pitfalls of myth in general. So I think we can worry about self-aggrandizement, about it being all the kind of delusion and that we'll start to feel too important. I think we can worry about kind of hardening into, I must do this because it's my vision and, you know, God told me to, the Buddha told me to, leading to a sort of religious fundamentalism that can be quite dangerous or seems like a danger. But more subtly, I think it can just start to be a bit of a sort of overlay to our experience. It can feel like something you're supposed to believe or conform to, or something you can sort of pressure yourself with not living up to. So I think it's really worth just looking out for those and seeing whether that is or isn't happening. It's important to stay true to what your resonances are, honest about them, and to just really acknowledge what the actual effects are on you in your actual experience. So if you start to imagine your place in this vast cosmos where you're influenced by the Buddha and working for the benefit of all with everybody here, what does that do for you? What's that like? Is it something that's going to help you to open and to flow? Is it going to give you energy? Is it going to help you to be kinder, more generous, or not? And just kind of keep an eye on that in yourself, really. So don't not engage because you think it might be a problem. Just try it and see what actually happens. Sangharakshita says, if you take a myth in the modern sophisticated sense, it has its effect on you. But if you're able to believe that myth is literally true, it has a much greater effect. You're likely to practice your religion more zealously and energetically. Of course, such literal belief can go to the undesirable extreme of fanatical fundamentalism. But avoiding that, perhaps we need to take care not to fall into too sophisticated or rational an approach to myth. The whole point about myth is that it is a realm of not clearly defined meanings, but of undefined, even indefinable meanings. It's the same realm to which belong such things as symbols, archetypal images, the imagination itself, and poetry. So for me, it gives meaning. It can make sense of what I'm doing in life. Last Thursday evening, we had the first week of an introductory course, and 80 new people turned up. We were completely packed out. It was slightly chaotic, but went very smoothly, considering. And when she heard, my friend Satya Leela said, you were clearly in the Mahayana. You were in a Mahayana sutra. And I thought, that makes sense of exactly what was going on. That is what it was like. It was like we had to expand our sense of what was possible. We had to expand the space available somehow. We hadn't got enough chairs and we hadn't got enough cups. And we had to just kind of be big enough to manage all that, really. It's just the sort of thing that happens in the Mahayana. They have a lot more than 90 people. They have thousands and thousands and thousands of beings in every gathering in Mahayana sutras, but it had that sort of flavour. And it certainly put me in touch with the number of people hungry for the Dharma. And the days afterwards, I just kept thinking, that's just a fraction of the people in Bristol who might be interested, who might respond, who might be able to be helped. And we can't fully meet even those 80, 90 people, really. I certainly can't do it as me alone. We needed to have a big team there to help, but we're not really going to be able to give all those people what it would take for them to really get free of mind-made suffering, to really take it deep enough. They won't all want to follow through, of course, but, you know, it's just like, wow, how would we really take that on? So it did just kind of just give me more sense of the possibility of what's out there that we could do together, and that between us we really could make a difference. We really could do something. We are creating just a little sphere where people can contact the Dharma and connect together. And yeah, we can provide conditions for some, at least, to really free themselves, really get free of the stress and suffering we give ourselves in our minds. So it's like it is a little Buddha land here. It really is. And it could be much bigger than we usually assume. We sort of could take off some of the limits we put on by assuming it's always going to be a certain way. But I just really get a sense that, you know, there is a bit of magic happening here. And between us, we really might build a Buddha land together. So our questions for our groups are suggested to talk about what gives you a sense of awe and wonder, what helps you feel at home, okay in yourself in that, and do you believe we're building a Buddha land here, and if you did, what might you do differently? What difference would it make? What difference would it make to you to really be part of building a Buddha land?